It's Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Welcome back. How you doing, Jordan?
Pretty good. Pretty busy, but doing good. How about you?
Yeah, same here. I feel like somehow, even though our schedules are very much the same, it's been busier. It's been more intense.
Yeah, I don't know why. Just, well, it's okay, though.
I don't know. I don't know if we said this in the last episode, but some exciting news is that we both found apartments.
Oh, yeah. Our,
yeah.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
It's making it very real.
I know. You're leaving before I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Because my program starts in August. And I just found out fairly recently as well that I have orientation on August 16th.
Wow. Okay. But when does the semester start?
I think later in August, like a week or two later.
Yeah. I don't know why orientation is so long. Like my quarter starts September 27th. They want me there September 12th.
Oh, so literally like 2 weeks.
2 weeks. I don't understand. I kind of wish, programs now are more mindful of how hectic moving is and would make or would keep a virtual orientation an option for people. It's kind of sad that they didn't do that, but it is what it is.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I think for a while, all of us, you know, during quarantining and social distancing, we were all like, oh, I can't wait to get off Zoom and like virtual things, meet back in person. And now that stuff is starting to be back in person again. You realize
how much easier it made things.
Yes. It's just, it gives you more flexibility to know that you can do something online. Does. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward to having class in person, but orientation for 2 weeks.
Yeah, is your orientation lasting the whole 2 weeks? Because I was under the impression that mine's only like a day or two.
Apparently mine is, yeah.
Oh my God.
Because I'd emailed them and I said, you know, I do have work. This means I would have to leave my job earlier. Is there any chance I could do some of these things virtually? And, you know, the person who emailed me back was like, no, it's almost every day there will be activities. I'm like,
doing what?
I don't know. I asked for a schedule and they're like, we won't give you a schedule until early September.
Oh my God.
But I want a plan.
Please, this is for grad school. We are not 8 years old. We don't need daily things.
That's what I was saying. Like, I remember when I was an undergrad, I thought, okay, orientation is good. This is helpful.
Yeah.
It's a good transition. But we're obviously not in that same place anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I've kind of given myself my own orientation by going to campus, checking it out, and all that.
Right.
And you've done the same.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, you might have also done this, but, like, I did kind of have like an open house type thing with professors on Zoom already. So it's like we've been introduced to professors and even some grad students. So I don't know why they would need you to be doing things for two weeks.
Not sure.
Oh my gosh. Well,
I guess it makes more sense for me since it is a 9-month program. It's going to be very fast paced. So they probably want to give us the opportunity before the semester starts to kind of prep us.
Yeah, maybe they have more things to go over in terms of, like, the timeline of just the whole program.
And
making
sure. So I can't complain. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm still very excited. It was just, it definitely shocked me that I had to be there earlier than I'd expected.
Yeah,
but it's okay.
Okay, well, that's exciting still.
Yeah. Anyway, so this week's artist, Emily Jasser. I had not heard of her up until a couple weeks ago when I was picking an artist for this week's episode. And like I said before, I was hesitant initially given what was going on. But when I found out that the cultural center that she had founded was raided, I thought, all right, I can't be quiet.
Yeah.
I want to talk about her. I want to use this platform to be able to talk about her. I don't know if you'd heard of her, Jordan, before this.
I had not, no. In kind of like the in-between time between the podcast episodes, I just, and I think I mentioned this to you privately before recording, but when I was just like looking at Art Forum and I did see an article about, like about her studio being raided and whatever. Yeah. So that, otherwise though, I had not heard of her before you mentioned her at the end of the last episode.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk about her. Her work is, it's stunning. It's very emotional, very intense, but it's incredibly powerful. I'll just dive right in, I guess. Jasser was born in 1972 in Bethlehem in the Palestinian West Bank. She spent most of her life growing up in Saudi Arabia. She attended high school in Italy, and then she eventually graduated from the Memphis College of Arts with an arts degree.
Wow.
Currently, she is a professor and member of the International Academy of Art in Palestine and a fellow of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation Rome Prize at the American Academy in Rome.
Wow.
She is renowned for her work. It is poetic as it is political and biographical. She has built a complex and compelling oeuvre. I don't know how to pronounce that, actually. Do you know how to pronounce that? Oeuvre in French. Yeah. So that, and it explores transformation, questions translation, resistance, and silenced historical narratives. Her work, it's a very important contribution to artistic inquiries about displacement and identity, which... the more episodes we do, the more I realize that that's something I'm very interested in. So, putting a pin on that for grad school. So, she is Palestinian, but she does have the American passport.
Okay.
Which is a very interesting position to be in because it kind of gave her more of an advantage than many other Palestinians. So, for years, she was allowed to travel to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. She could move across borders. This privilege of movement became a very important element of her artistic practice. Since 2004, however, the situation has obviously deteriorated severely. Palestinians who hold foreign passports are much more restricted in their movement in Palestine and Israel than ever before.
Wow.
But before I get into that, I figured I'd provide more detail about what happened recently. So in 2014, Jasser established the Dar Yusuf Nasr Jasser for art and research with her sister, filmmaker Anne-Marie Jasser. The organization is based out of a 19th century stone house in Bethlehem that was actually home to their late grandparents. So the center, which Jasser co-directs with Aline Khoury, offers cultural and educational programming to the local population. And it also runs a residency program for international artists.
Oh, cool.
And actually, one artist that was there was Coco Fusco, who Jordan and I both know.
Yes.
She was actually a professor of art at UF for the longest time. Yeah. Is she still?
I don't know, because I feel like I saw something recently where it, like, mentioned another university with her name. And so I think...
maybe, yeah.
I think she might have left. But she was at UF as, like, a distinguished professor for a while.
She was a pretty big name at the School of Art and Art History. So it was very exciting to find out that she actually did a residency at the Cultural Center.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a great idea, and they did this as sisters, and I think it's very powerful. Unfortunately, last month, on the night of Saturday, May 15th, Israeli army forces breached and ransacked the center, causing extensive damage to the building and confiscating equipment, including phones, computers, hard drives, cameras, and books. According to Jasser, there were over a dozen of them, and they blew open the locks with the same special tool they've been using to get into Palestinians' houses. Images from the aftermath of the raid show shattered windows, broken doors, riot control ammunition strewn across the floor and around the building. And even days before the raid, the center's communal garden was destroyed by fires from Israeli projectiles. So... Yeah, so it remains unclear whether the Israeli army had specifically targeted the center.
Mm-hmm.
But something worth noting is that, you know, Israeli authorities had raided and ransacked three cultural centers in East Jerusalem the year before.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention this because, you know, I know it's uncomfortable. I know people probably don't want to hear this, but it's the reality. And I don't know, this is more than just tension or conflict. This is an attempt of erasure of Palestinian culture and heritage. This is one example of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed this to be an episode that addressed that, both from a moral but also personal standpoint, because my grandmother's Palestinian. Her mother and the family, you know, were exiled in 48 when everything really started to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, it's always interesting. I've always forgotten that I do have Palestinian heritage.
Yeah.
Because it's just, I haven't had the opportunity to explore that aspect of my identity. You know, I hear stories from my grandmother and, you know, her brother who lives in Los Angeles right now. But I don't know. It's something that I never really recognized about myself up until recently. So
mm-hmm.
that's why I kind of wanted to bring that part up.
Yeah.
But
go ahead. Just just going to let you keep going. Yeah,
oh, you're no, good. Okay.
I think it's great that you're doing it.
Thank you. So yeah, in any case, long before this happened, Jasser is deeply tied to her roots, and she utilized her freedom of movement with the American passport to implement it into her practice. So I will be going in chronological order with her projects. So before talking about the specific piece where she utilized her passport, there's one before it. It's called Memorial to 418 Palestinian Villages, which were destroyed, depopulated, and occupied by Israel in 1948. Mm. So this was in 2001. It was the result of a three-month community-based project in New York. She erected this family-sized refugee tent in her New York studio and stenciled the names of all the villages that were archived in Walid Khalid's book, All That Remains, the Palestinian Villages Occupied and Depopulated by Israel in 1948. Pretty self-explanatory.
Wow. Yeah.
What those villages are. So it's actually interesting because when I found out about that, I wonder what village my grandmother's from. I don't even know that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because I think my great-grandmother was exiled around 48, I believe. But yeah, so it was a community-based project because over 140 people came to her studio to embroider the names. And anytime they were there together as a group, they would tell stories, they would socialize, or maybe recount how each village was destroyed. And it was often accompanied by live Arabic music.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah. So the people who collaborated to make Memorial were bankers, lawyers, filmmakers, dentists, consultants, playwrights, artists, activists, teachers, etc., etc. Basically, people from all over. Most of them were Palestinians. Some of them came from the villages in question. Some were Israelis who grew up in the remains of these villages.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, they were joined by people from a multitude of backgrounds, which is really nice to hear, just knowing that, you know, they're pinned against one another, and yet here they are coming together to, I guess, to deliver the same message, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. But yeah.
Yeah.
So the piece was made during a brief period that Jasser spent in New York, along with many other Palestinian compatriots. And the memorial is accompanied by a book with a daily log documenting all of the participants while they were there in her studio.
Cool.
Yeah.
So in the book, mm-hmm. you said it's a log. Is that just like written? Like, did she just write kind of like notes, or are there photos as well?
Yeah, I couldn't find photos as I was looking for it, but I believe it's a written daily log.
Okay.
Just, she probably had that open in her studio and, you know, the participants would come in and sign it.
Oh, okay. I got
Yeah.
that. Okay.
I hope I can find a picture. I'll keep looking and yeah. post that on social media. But if not, you know, people can check out the tent itself on mm-hmm. our Instagram. So, yeah, that's one of her earlier works in 2001. And then this other series that I wanted to talk about is Where We Come From. It's between 2002 and 2003. It's a collection of installations, research-based films, photographs, and performances inspired by a lack of freedom for a people. So, you know, where do you come from? That's not really an easy question for Palestinians to answer, given the circumstances. Some people may name places they no longer have access to.
Mm-hmm.
have different names, or no longer even physically exist. With this in mind, and with her freedom of movement as someone with an American passport, she started going up to Palestinian people and asking them the following question. If I could do anything for you anywhere in Palestine, what would it be? And she basically began running errands for friends and for acquaintances.
Oh.
And she got so many requests. Some were very pragmatic and mundane, but others were extremely intimate.
Oh.
You know, it resulted in photographs, texts, films, documenting the impact of the political situation on the everyday lives of Palestinians. So I got very choked up when I found examples of what people asked of her.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm good now. I don't think I'm going to get choked up when I read these. But I'm just saying it because I was actually texting Jordan as I was doing research. I said, oh my God, this is a lot.
Yeah.
So here are some of the requests that people gave Jasir. Go to the Israeli post office in Jerusalem and pay my phone bill. Go to Beit Lahia and bring me a photo of my family, especially my brother's kids. Drink the water in my parents' village. Go to Gaza and eat siyadi. That's actually a really good, like, fish-based dish. I don't really know how to fully describe it, but my grandma made it quite a bit, and it was good. Oh, God, this one. Visit my mother, hug and kiss her, and tell her that these are from her son. Visit the sea at sunset and smell it for me and walk a little bit. Enough. Am I being greedy?
Oh, my God. I'm going to get teary.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Go to my mother's grave in Jerusalem on her birthday and put flowers and pray.
Oh.
Yeah. So that sucked to read.
Yeah, it's powerful to hear this.
It's ridiculous. Like, from the simplest thing that a person cannot go pay their phone bill,
mm-hmm.
or even to something as intense of, I can't go visit my mother.
Yeah.
Or see my family.
Yeah.
Because I'm not allowed to move. Ugh. I'm just trapped in one, like an open air prison, essentially. So she wanted to keep going with this, but in 2004, you know, new laws were implemented that denied her the ability to move freely across borders.
I don't understand.
I know. But. And she actually, I'm not talking about these in detail today, but she does have a couple of films where she kind of documents the process of crossing borders within Israel.
Hmm.
Like from Gaza to maybe the Jerusalem or other places. But she kind of shows the absurdity of it. I think at one point they walk 2 kilometers to get to a checkpoint. Like walk, not even drive, which is ridiculous. But yeah, you can access those films. You can find them online.
Okay.
But yeah, so because of what happened in 2004, she could not continue with the project.
Mm.
And in an addendum that she wrote in 2006, she says, and I'm quoting here, I am no longer allowed to enter Gaza and certain Palestinian towns in the West Bank. Israel is relentlessly moving forward in the construction of the apartheid wall, which began in the spring of 2002. Palestinians with foreign passports are increasingly being denied entry into the country by Israel at all border crossings and are being forced to immigrate. Israel has decided that freedom of movement is no longer a right for American passport holders and has created measures to ensure this.
It doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. And her wording is interesting here, right? Like, especially the last sentence. She doesn't say they're depriving Palestinians the right to movement. They're depriving American passport holders.
Yeah. So with that,
moving.
Is that specifically like Palestinians with an American passport or just anyone with an? Okay.
I'm pretty sure though. I don't think Americans would be allowed to move freely either, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But yeah, like it's so frustrating. Yeah. You know, and especially when she's trying to create something that's so deeply personal and powerful, and you know, it's silly things like this that kind of prevent her from doing that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is where we come from. Another project that she worked on is called Material for a Film. It started in 2006. From the websites that I found, it says that it's still ongoing, but I'm not sure whether that's the case. Mm-hmm. It is, however, one of her best known works. She brought this to the Venice Biennale in 2007.
Okay.
And she actually won the Golden Lion Prize for the film there, which is, you know, the biggest prize you could get at the Biennale.
Mm-hmm.
It's a large-scale installation based on the life of Palestinian writer Wael Zweiter. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. If not, well, sorry. But Zweiter was the first victim in Europe in a series of assassinations of Palestinian artists, intellectuals, and diplomats perpetrated by Israeli agents. On October 16, 1972, Zweiter was gunned down by 12 bullets outside his apartment in Piazza Anibaliano, Rome.
Wow.
Rome. He was killed in Rome.
Oh my God.
And apparently several other Palestinians were in Europe. I don't remember the name of the soldiers or the Israeli agents, but there was a name for them. And there were just a group of them in Europe specifically targeting, you know, Palestinian people.
That's insane.
Yeah. In the 70s. So that happened. And I don't remember the details of what happened to my my grandmother's brother, but I think it was around the same time, and tensions were on the rise in Lebanon because of the civil war, but he was almost gunned down on the street. He was almost killed because of being Palestinian, and the only reason he was able to get away was because the shooter got distracted. Yeah.
Oh my God, wait, and where was this? Was this still in Lebanon?
This was Lebanon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh my
God. Yeah. Ever since then, he has not come back. He just left to the States and never came back.
That's so unfortunate, but I don't blame him. I mean,
yeah.
Wow, that's awful.
It is what it is, yeah. So I was surprised that they were even doing this in Europe, but that's what happened. He was assassinated in 1979. Zweiter's companion of 8 years, she's Sydney-born artist, Janet Veen Brown, published for a Palestinian a memorial to Wael Zweiter. One chapter specifically was called Material for a Film by Elio Petri and Ugo Piro, and it contained a series of interviews conducted with people who were part of Zweiter's life in Italy. They were supposed to make a film out of it, but Petri died shortly afterwards, and the film was never realized. This is where Jasser steps in. Hence why her piece is called Material for a Film, based off of the chapter's name.
Wow.
Yeah. So she went to Rome in 2005 and started collecting material for the film. She visited his friends in Rome, Massa Carrara, and elsewhere. She also made several trips to Nablus, a city in the northern West Bank, to visit his sister Naila and to see his family home where he grew up. Also, this is a side note. I just find it funny how my accent kind of comes up as I'm trying to pronounce these Arabic names. Like, I definitely said sister in like an Arabic accent right before I actually said her name. It's my brain is all over the place
it's
right
okay.
now.
It's okay. I'm like trying to. I'll hear it maybe when I listen back. I didn't you, notice it like live.
You probably will. To anyone else listening who understands code switching and probably deals with it too, please don't laugh at me. You know what I'm going through.
I'm sure no one would be laughing at you.
Probably not. They'd probably just relate.
Yeah.
But anyways, so yes, between Rome and, you know, the West Bank, she was visiting his family. And then she did visit Van Braun, his companion in Rome, regularly. She spent many weeks with her, calling on Zweiter's old friends and going through Van Braun's extensive archives. Jasser even found a letter that Van Braun wrote to the filmmaker Kostas Gavras, asking him to consider making a film about Zweiter, because Van Braun believed that through his story, that of thousands of other Palestinians could be told.
Mm-hmm.
She also said this about Zweiter to Jasser. He was a poet. He was completely lost without poetry.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, in our link tree, you can find an article that Jasser wrote that I pulled most of the information from, and it has a couple clips / texts about Zweiter. And one specifically that I found so interesting is, to get some extra cash, he worked as an extra on films, including Pink Panther in 1963.
Oh my God.
Yeah, which is so interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
And apparently, so the website says this, well, it's Van Braun talking about this. Apparently, he was so charismatic that, you know, the directors wanted to pull him from being an extra and give him, like, a speaking role.
Uh-huh.
But any time the cameras turned to him and he had to say his lines, he just froze.
Oh, no.
It just never worked out.
Oh.
Yeah. So, she actually, Van Braun said that she was so disappointed to go to the theater and watch this film and only see him for a split second.
Yeah.
But it's because he kind of choked.
Oh.
When he had to say his lines.
It's
but
okay.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's fine. We will remember him.
Yeah.
Through this story. But yeah, so that one is the film. Well, this is the thing with her work. It's very, very much like multimedia when you think about it, because you will see the finished product of, you know, the where we come from, where she ran errands for everyone. But that, like, the process of it itself, that is a performance.
Yeah.
That she went and did all of this, right?
Yeah.
And then after that, she wrote the text in both English and Arabic. She made notes of her trips in those texts. Some of them that we've posted on social media might be difficult to read. You can try to zoom in. Otherwise, you know, you can access them online and probably find the texts on their own. But yeah, and then, you know, the tent. Sure, the finished piece is very powerful, but then you think about, oh, over 140 people coming into her studio, listening to music, talking together. You know, how incredible would it be for that to be a performance piece on its own, where, you know, viewers were able to watch that, or if she put together a film of that, which I wish she did, but, so yeah, it's all a performance, and in that performance, she produces photographs, texts, films, you name it, you know, and I think that's what's so impressive about her work.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to finish off with this final project of hers. It was from 2010 to 2012. It's called Ex Libri, and it was originally commissioned by Documenta, and it commemorates approximately 30,000 books that were looted from Palestinian homes, libraries and institutions by Israeli authorities in 1948.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 30,000 books.
Wow.
Which is ridiculous. So the project spans various techniques, including film, photography, sound, writing, video, archiving, and performance. Again, that's pretty much all she does, really. Mm-hmm. Well, she does everything. So out of those 30,000, 6,000 are still kept at the Jewish National and University Library in Jerusalem. Hmm. They're cataloged as AP. Do you know what that stands for?
No.
Abandoned property.
Okay. Abandoned, sure.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Not stolen, not looted. Abandoned property.
That's insane.
Yeah. Oh my God. So, Jocelyn visited the library repeatedly over the course of 2 years, and she photographed all 6,000 books.
Wow.
All of them. On her cell phone. The Nokia N8, to be specific.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 2 years of going in and taking pictures. And, you know, she ultimately, in that process, addresses the looting and the destruction of books, but also raises questions about themes of repatriation and restitution. Like, when will these be returned? They should be returned to their rightful owners, obviously, if they're, mm-hmm. well, they're no longer alive, but to their...
The heirs.
To the generations that followed, yeah. She believed, which I think is a very interesting way that she worded this, that the only way to represent oblivion was through the anger, spark, and strong imagery, videos, or photographs that captured the evidence.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's... I like that she mentions that, you know, to represent it through anger. Mm-hmm. Not in a violent way, but, you know, she's angry. So many others are angry.
Yeah.
And by this simple act of going to a library for 2 years, taking pictures of 6,000 books, you know, that's not anger. I don't know what is.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, so with her first visits, she initially just wanted to document the book's inscriptions, so the names of the authors. But as she kept working, she became more interested in the small traces that she found in the books. The margins, stains, scribbles, paper scraps.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much there. Those weren't library books, you know, those were people's books that they've left their marks on,
yeah.
and that were taken from them. So, you know, there are these little stories, like a coffee stain, or a bookmark, or just some notes on the side.
Mm-hmm.
So she went through all the books, and specifically those in the library's Oriental Reading Room, which is kind of a concerning way to name a reading room, but yeah. I'm not surprised. Anyway, so she was looking for any that had been assimilated into the main library system, realizing that, you know, they were selected by authorities for particular purposes, mm-hmm. which makes sense because there were 30,000 of them. Somehow only 6,000 are in the library. Where are the others, you know?
Right, yeah.
Why did those not make the cut?
Mm-hmm.
And if she found inscriptions, she translated them to German and English and exhibited them in public places, kind of like on billboards. And again, this is all on our Instagram. The images will be up by the time this episode comes up. So some of these are really just kind of like, I guess, you know, how you sign a book for someone just as a little message for them. Yeah. So a couple of the billboards, one of them says, "To a dear friend and great research historian, Omar Efendi Barghouti, a gift, respect, and appreciation from the author Arif al-Arif." And then another one was, "This book belongs to its owner, Fathullah Saad. He bought it with his own money, Gaza, March 1892. Completely messed that up, it's fine. But, I don't know, I really love that second one because it's just, he bought it with his own money. I feel like that's someone younger who was probably very proud of the purchase.
Yeah, being especially such an old book.
Yeah, 1892.
That's wild.
That's wild. I know. And it's so funny to think about because for the longest time growing up, I would sign my books with the date. So I think I never wrote my name. I put my signature.
That's cute.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's so powerful. And she kind of took it one step further. So these billboards that were up, they were specifically in Kassel, Germany. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but
for like where Documenta is held.
Yeah. So as part of the project, she also visited the Morhard Library in Kassel, where she noticed a couple remaining books that weren't damaged when the city was bombed in 1941. And that location is specifically where the Nazis infamously burned like 100,000 books.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was actually looking up the location, I saw this piece. It's there where the books were burned. Mm-hmm. It's called The Parthenon of Books. I forgot the name of the artist, but it looks so beautiful. I don't know if anyone's heard of this, but if you haven't, you should definitely check it out. It's essentially in the shape of the Parthenon, and it looks like it's made of book pages.
Oh, wow.
It's very impressive.
I'm going to look that up after.
Yeah. So when she was in that library, the librarian told her 60 to 80 bombs hit the town, but not even one hit the library tower.
Oh my God.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. That's, oh wow.
I know. So it's, again, when you read about the process of all of her pieces, it's just even more profound than the final product itself. Mm-hmm. But the way it's exhibited as an installation is actually pretty barren. It's kind of like an ode to nothingness, of an endless shadow of emptiness.
Hmm.
If you look at the way it's displayed in an exhibition room, it's just completely empty. It's nothing but shelves of the pictures of the books she took.
Yeah.
There's no banners. There's no explanations. There's no documentations about the situation. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just was thinking it's almost like, the absence of the books is represented in the absence of the wall text or just the blank space in the gallery.
Spoken like a true art historian.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, no, exactly. It's all aimed at displaying the emptiness, you know, of that loss of those confiscated and looted property.
Yeah.
And taking quotes from the article that I found this on, the primary focus of this piece is showcasing the strong relationship between books and the land on the impression of custodianship and salvation. It addresses the looting and the destruction of books and raises the hard question of expulsion and compensation. The books show that they have suffered further damage through pre-selection, though the restitution of Palestinian property has not yet taken place.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
It really is amazing, and I'm just thinking even, from personal experience, how much a book can be, identified with someone or how it can come to signify a person or a group of people. And,
yeah,
I mean, that's, what you were saying, where the Nazis in the early 20th century burned thousands and thousands of books because it's the same thing, by destroying the books and it's like destroying the people through a tangible thing, which is just, oh, it's awful.
It's pretty horrific. And, you know, I kind of like how she bridged what happened to Palestinians with 30,000 of their books being looted to what happened in that city in Germany, in that town in Germany.
Yeah.
With the also 100,000 books being burned.
Yeah.
So
it's coincidental, but in the best way in terms of the artistic.
Right. Exactly. Because the one in Germany was 1941 and then in Palestine it was 48. So, not that far apart.
No.
Yeah. So, that's Djoser. I'll finish off with kind of, I thought this was a very beautiful way to summarize her work. And I figured I'd finish off the episode with it. I'll go ahead and read that. The strength in Djoser's body of work lies in the fact that she reveals to a wide audience the complex and vastly layered reality of Palestine, a territory described by the late Mahmoud Darwish, widely regarded as the national poet of Palestine, as a country of words. Mm. Be it due to redrawn borders, erased villages and towns, or the experience of exile, Palestine is a place often evoked through words and memories, and Emily Djoser, through her artistic rituals, helps reunite parts of it with its people, speaking out for the many Palestinians who do not have a platform to be heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
So her work is so, like, understated and powerful at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
You look at it and you think, oh, that's fairly simple. And then you read what she did to put all of these projects together, and it's so incredibly profound.
Yeah.
It's some of the most profound work I've seen in a while.
Yeah. It's really, I feel like the world is lucky to have artists like her then who are able to, you know, communicate and
agreed
and bring these sorts of memories and events to the present when so many of us don't know about them just because of history that's not talked about.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hope that as the cultural center rebuilds, they are able to do that soon.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not too intense of a process because, you know, Palestinians deserve centers like that.
Mm-hmm. The world does. So, I mean, you.
The world does, yeah.
Because, I mean, they hosted other international artists.
They hosted international artists, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So there you go.
Wow. Well, thank you. I'm so glad that you found out about her and decided to present about her.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Of course. She's so cool, so.
She is very cool.
I was glad to learn about her.
Yeah. So how about you? What are you talking about next time? Who are you talking about next time?
I feel like this is, like, hard to follow up.
No, not at all.
I'm talking about she's an artist, but she primarily works in film. Her name is Rosa Barba. Yeah. Okay. I always, in my head, after I say her name, I'm like, it's not Barbara. No, it's Barba.
Very close.
Rosa Barba.
Fine.
Yeah, she is from Italy, and yeah, she does a lot of film and installations. And I first saw a video of her when I was in, or not a video of her, a video by her when I was in Venice. So, you know, you mentioned the Biennale earlier. This was not the Biennale, but it was in Venice.
Okay.
And I saw one of her pieces, and it was very cool, very interesting. Mm. So I'm excited to talk about her next time.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm excited to learn about her.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I
think that's about it. As always, you can check out everything on our Instagram. We're not as active on Twitter, but I'll be sure to update that as well.
Yes.
And again, all sources are available on our link trees. So thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Take care.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.